I don't know, have you heard about the Meta Universe or not? The Metaverse and the Meta Project, okay, is a project that the giants of high tech are doing in order to establish, create the goggles that you put on your eyes, and then you enter into a world which is absolutely based on the virtual science. You can make your land, you can buy it. And, you know,
the same company who built the Bitcoin and all those, now they're selling the properties. For example, Taj Mahal has been already sold over there.
Virtual property.
The virtual property, virtual lands.
Yes. And they said that this will finish the corruption. Why? Because everyone knows what you own.
Yes.
So no one can, you know, take it from you. No one can invade you. You know, they cannot crack. The point is, the one who has made this software can crack you. He already has bought everything for himself.
Has got into your mind, you know, through the goggles. You can make your own personality, even with your own characteristics. If you are short in this world, you can make a tall person out of yourself. If you are, I don't know. You
I
know,
remember
this,
there was a movie as well. Yes. Hollywood made it.
Player One. Player One by Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Player One, yeah. So player in one. That, they put one. The goggles, they don't have the real, in the real world, they don't know each other. They're always got involved in that. The general public, they have different, those who are involved in the IT, they have different, you know, methods. The lawyers, the politicians, they have their own, you know, duties to, they have their own duties to, you know, to perform. So therefore, the methodologies are different. And at this point, obviously, it is hard to just identify. We can identify a couple of them, but not all of them.
Yes.
We cannot just talk about all of them.
Okay.
But obviously, it should be, whatever we do, it should be first, be prioritized.
Yes.
First of all, you cannot just do anything. You cannot just put hand in anything. Number two, it should be, you know, in line with the Islamic Revolution. Because that's the lesson which we learn, obviously.
It should be in line.
It should be in line with the Islamic Revolution.
Okay.
It should be with the scientific and logical support and expertise. It cannot be without that. And be practical. You know, sometimes we want to do something, but in practical life, we are lazy. So your practice and what you think should be the same. And the last thing, but not least, avoid corruption and sedition. You know, sometimes we think that, okay, someone has put a material about me on the internet or somewhere else. I need to save Islam, for example. I cannot put something which is based on lies against that person. You know, the corruption, this is a kind of corruption. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be...
So this jihadist habit must be ethical too.
That is important. Yes. It should be ethical and true. Because Islam is the religion of truth.
Yes.
So we don't need any lies.
We do not play the dirty game
which they are doing. Yeah. We don't need that.
When it comes to the tools required, you know, one is, as Sayyid has mentioned too, the adequate knowledge, right?
Yes.
Being empowered with the knowledge and knowing the subject you're addressing. The second is the ability to promote the correct intellectual discourse, right? Knowledge in itself, you know, which is all over the place, is not enough, right? So you have to develop, and if you already have it, good. If not, then you have to develop the ability to promote the correct intellectual discourse.
That's right.
The third one is the ability to follow the proper reasoning and principles of logic. You know, sometimes people, when they get into this confrontational situation, they put aside logic.
They become emotional
and just, you know, that doesn't help.
Yes.
The fourth one is Islamic akhlaq, as the leader himself has mentioned, the ethics and morals, which, you know, involves and includes taqwa and sincerity.
That's right.
This is something that's a prerequisite for anyone to enter into this jihad. Without this, you're going to do more damage than benefit.
Yes.
Then acquaintance with social media tools and techniques.
Yes, like, this is important.
You know, this is very important. If you're going to use it as a means to get to people, you need to know how to work it. And last but not the least is access to verifiable information, data, and subject matter experts.
That's all right. It's really, I think, a specialized teamwork in order to be done on Jihad al-Tabin. I hope that different groups of the people and those who are interested in this concept, you know, come into the field and, you know, come into the practical aspects of Jihad al-Tabin, because here and there we can see so many people on the members, on the, you know, sermons, giving lectures on the universities and the houses, talking about this. But first of all, we have to understand what is Jihad al-Tabim, what are the categories, what are the main tools. Recently, a book also have been published titled as Jihad al-Tabim by Intisharat Inqilab Islami, Islamic Revolution publication, compiled by Sayyid Sulh Mirzai, which is a great book. I think it is about more than 500 pages. It is in Farsi language. I hope it's been translated into English language, other languages too. It's a good book, you know, on Jihad al-Tabim, and what Rahbar has emphasized on different aspects of this Jihad al-Tabim, Jihad for or of clarification and explanation. Okay, thank you much.
You're welcome.
Sheikh Ali, really fruitful discussion. And Sayyid Mohsen, thank you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us to another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how people in the subcontinent observe International Quds Day to reaffirm their solidarity with the oppressed people in Palestine. And we shall also take a look at how this day resonates with people in places like India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir in the context of their own struggles.
Four decades after the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini envisioned the day to reaffirm solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle for the liberation of occupied territories. Every year, on the last Friday of Ramadan, people across the world rally for the great cause. Some of the biggest international Quds Day rallies are witnessed in places such as India, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Kashmir, where it also resonates with the people's own social and political struggles.
International Quds Day has over the years become synonymous with a nation of solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine in their struggle for the liberation of the third holiest sanctuary for Muslims. But as Imam Khomeini quite clearly stressed back in 1979, the day is not exclusive to Palestine and Jerusalem, but seeks to raise awareness about oppression everywhere in the world. The message resonates loudly with people in places like India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Kashmir. In Afghanistan, for example, International Quds Day has for years been used as a psychological mechanism to mobilize masses against the US-led foreign military occupation that lasted 20 years, as well as terrorist groups like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In neighboring Pakistan, International Quds Day rallies see people chanting vociferous slogans against terrorist groups, including Daesh, Tehrik Taliban Pakistan, Lashkar Jangvi, as well as new imperial powers hell-bent on destabilizing the country. In India, the day resonates with people's struggle against the alarming rise in Islamophobia and the growing proximity between the ominous forces of Hindutva and Zionism. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, International Quds Day has become an important annual event to speak truth to power, to rally for freedom from all forms and manifestations of oppression and subjugation.
The Himalayan region of Kashmir is one of the places where International Quds Day is observed with unadulterated zeal. The Muslim-majority territory sees massive processions on the occasion, both to express solidarity with the people of Palestine and to give voice to their own sufferings. Quds Day has become a permanent feature on the annual calendar of Kashmir, where Imam Khomeini is deeply revered and his messages are followed in letter and spirit. The day also holds extra significance as the stories of Kashmir and Palestine run parallel to each other.
Every year, International Quds Day rallies are held in different parts of Indian-controlled Kashmir with massive participation. People cutting across sectarian and ideological lines take part in these rallies. Kashmir and Palestine have many things in common: the imposed war, military occupation, settler colonialism, and people without voice and agency. For years, Kashmiris have spoken in one voice against Israeli atrocities in the occupied Palestinian territories. On many occasions, people have been arrested in pro-Palestine demonstrations. For example, in June 2021, at least 21 people were taken into police custody in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, for chanting pro-Palestine slogans. Among them was a mural artist who painted "We Are Palestine" and showed a woman with her head wrapped in a Palestinian flag. Pro-Palestine murals, graffiti and slogans across the contested region show a shared sense of solidarity. Authorities fear these actions may lead to a wider socio-political movement against Indian rule in Kashmir. While India has rebuffed multiple UN resolutions calling for a plebiscite in Kashmir, Israel has brazenly dismissed numerous UN resolutions on Palestine's right to liberation from the Zionist occupation. But that has not prevented them from continuing their struggles and fighting on for their rights.
In Muslim-majority Pakistan, rallying for the cause of Palestine has become an article of faith for the people, while the position of successive governments also remains unchanged. On the International Quds Day, massive demonstrations are held in major cities such as Karachi, Lahore, Islamabad and Peshawar, which also sees the participation of major political and religious organizations. Furthermore, it becomes an occasion for people in Pakistan to raise their voice against foreign interference in their own country and the wider region, in line with Imam Khomeini's immortal message.
When the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, called on the campaigners of truth and justice worldwide to commemorate the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as the day of Al-Quds, people in Pakistan were among the first to stand up and take to the streets. Over the years, the tradition of expressing solidarity with the people of Palestine and other oppressed people on International Quds Day has been upheld with exemplary passion and conviction. The massive street rallies see the participation of people from all walks of life who march under one flag, the flag of resistance. These marches are generally organized by the National Solidarity Council of Pakistan, Majlis Wahdat-e-Muslimin Pakistan, and the Imamiyah Students Organization. These organizations have openly come out in support of the Palestinian resistance movements, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, while denouncing Arab countries for normalizing relations with the Israeli regime. International Quds Day also brings people in Pakistan together to denounce America's destabilizing activities in the country, as well as sponsorship of terrorist groups active in the region. The country has seen a surge of violence recently amid the resurgence of terrorist groups like Daesh and Tehrik Taliban Pakistan, who many observers believe are backed by Western spy agencies.
If you are a true Muslim and a believer in the oneness of God and the message of the Prophet, then you help everybody who is oppressed or weak. And you give them a hand when you can. You give them some material support when you can. And if you can't, you do with your prayers and your da'wah. Wherever there is a Muslim brother who is being oppressed or maltreated, we've got to stand up and try to help. Otherwise, the word ummah means nothing. And that is what Western colonization and Zionism have been trying to do for the last 100 years or so, to divide the ummah on the doctrine, divide and rule.
In India, which is the world's second most populous country, home to more than 10% of world Muslims, solidarity with the people of Palestine is deeply ingrained in the country's socio-political fabric. The International Quds Day generates tremendous enthusiasm in big Indian cities, with large street rallies participated by both Muslims and Hindus. This is while the government in New Delhi has in recent years drawn closer to Israel with lucrative defense deals, marking a departure from India's traditional position on the Palestine issue.
On International Quds Day every year, slogans like "Down with Israel" and "Down with the US" reverberate across India as thousands of people pour into the streets in solidarity with the people of Palestine and in protest to the occupation of the holy city of Al-Quds. Among the biggest gatherings is the one held at Jantar Mantar, a popular protest site in the heart of New Delhi. Cities with a sizable Muslim population, including Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad and Lucknow, also see massive street rallies on the day, with the participation of people from both Muslim and Hindu communities. People in India have traditionally been staunch supporters of the Palestinian cause. However, the official Indian position on Israel's occupation of Palestine has seen a drastic change in recent years. In 1948, India was the only non-Muslim state to vote against the UN partition plan of Palestine. In the 1967 and 1973 wars, India denounced Israel as the aggressor. In the early 1990s, the policy began to change with the opening of the Indian embassy in Tel Aviv. Since 2014, when the Hindu nationalist BJP came to power, India has made its pro-Israel stance very clear, much to the chagrin of Indians who remain loyal to the Palestinian cause.
Well, all these people, they don't support anybody. They support their interests. I mean, Modi was dancing tango with Netanyahu in the open in the last few years. And now with the new advent of Ukraine, and people are sort of looking inwardly and saying, this is in the interest of my people, this isn't. And he is not supporting Palestine, he's supporting India. Like he said to America, no, I will not condemn Russia because they're offering me cheap oil. They were very, very open about it. Mercenary, yes, but this is politics, and this is modern politics, because unfortunately, since the Second World War, when America took the lead single-handedly ruling over the world, things have changed. No more principles, no more morals. It's gains and conquests and what you can get. And they've been doing it all over the world. Unfortunately, we in the Arab and Muslim world got our unfair share of American largesse at the point of a gun.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Wafiq Faour, an activist and member of Vermonters for Justice in Palestine. Now, welcome to the program, sir. As we know, almost 43 years after the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, gave the call for International Quds Day, the biggest rallies today are held in the Indian subcontinent. So what is it that brings people to the streets in such large numbers on this special day?
Ayatollah Khomeini, and with the definitely acceptance of the rest of the world, mainly the Palestinian movement, that time when he announced it, they are very welcoming, because we as Palestinians, we understand Al-Quds, quote-unquote Jerusalem, is not a Palestinian cause or an Arab cause only. It's a Muslim cause and it's international cause. And every year, as I am observing it, I notice that it's becoming bigger, because Al-Quds is a central issue to all Muslims around the world. I think Khomeini was... he read the future more than anybody else, believing that Al-Quds going to be central to the Palestinian question and the question between the survival of Israel as a colonial entity on the Middle East or the demise of that entity. And I believe he was futuristic and smart to do what he did.
Mr. Faour, as you mentioned before, Imam Khomeini affirmed that this day is not exclusive to Palestine and Jerusalem, but is dedicated to all the oppressed across the world. So how does International Quds Day today resonate with people in places like India, Pakistan, Kashmir, and also Afghanistan?
I'm not going to deny that there is oppression everywhere. I mean, you mentioned on India, the Muslim region of Kashmir and Afghanistan in particular. I mean, oppression is all over the world. Those two are central as well. I believe there is no difference between our struggle and the Kashmir struggle, because they want independence and self-determination as the Palestinians. On Afghanistan, I think it's a little bit different, because I don't believe the American occupation of Afghanistan is obsolete yet, and still they have a hand of what's going on over there, including the changing of the government of Pakistan just recently. I believe you have forces in the Western world who are creating the modern colonialism, that they're not going to let go of what's going on. They will never accept losing the battle and the occupation of Afghanistan. They still have power within the Pakistani army and the Pakistani system. And maybe it will take time, but things are changing quickly, mainly after what's going on Ukraine and Russia. And I believe everything going parallels, and the effect of that war, we we cannot predict it completely this early, on this early time.
Now, sir, in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, international Quds Day rallies have also focused on foreign interference and activities of Western-backed terrorist groups. This is while many see the hand of Western and its spy agencies behind the recent terrorist incidents in Afghanistan. So what's your assessment on this, Mr. Fowle?
You see, on Afghanistan, it is still not free yet from 20 years of war from the American occupation. And I think they left many elements and created many elements similar that what they are creating on Syria, on Libya, on many parts of the Muslim world, that they still on the payroll of the American CIA and American forces. And I believe those forces and those terrorist group, those extremists, they are creating what we don't wanna see on the Middle East. And it started before 9/11, but 9/11 was clear, because until now, we didn't read the full story of 9/11 and who created Osama bin Laden and those Wahhabi group, those extremists. But the world at one point will learn that much of extremism, it was a Western creation. American up front, but it had been supported by other Western forces as well.
Now, Mr. Fowle, what about India? People in India have traditionally been staunch supporters of the Palestinian cause, but the official Indian position has drastically altered in recent years. So why do you think that is?
The Indian government, as I read what's going on in Kashmir, they are extremists as well. The Hindu movement, they want to create a sectarian problem similar to what the West is creating in Afghanistan, on Syria, and in the Middle East, that they want to divide the public based on their sect and their religious background. And they made the Sunnah Shia as a fight, and this is the struggle of what's going on the Middle East. The only beneficiary of this kind of division is the colonialist power that created and have been forced upon us from the West. This is the major problem, that some people bought to this idea that we are divided, even though our goals are the same. More things, 99%, I mean, Muslim, Sunnah or Shia, they believe on the same book, the same Muslim tradition. There isn't that division that the West have to like to highlight and to make it possible for them. The whole idea of creating this upheaval is to keep the West their foothold in our land.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Fowle for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmir-based photojournalist Sayed Shahriar shares pictures taken at the International Quds Day rally in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, in 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic broke out. Dr. Hafizur Rahman, a New Delhi-based university professor and author, says he addressed the International Quds Day gathering at Jantar Mantar, a popular protest site in the heart of the Indian capital. Pakistani social media activist Sheikh Salim Ahmad notes that Pakistan has always supported the Palestinian cause, sharing pictures from International Quds Day rally held in Faisalabad city. Mirway Salamzoy, an Afghan journalist, asserts that oppression faced by Palestinians is akin to the oppression faced by all Muslims, adding that preparations are afoot for observing International Quds Day in Afghanistan. Kashmir-based university student Farooq Farhan shares a picture taken at the International Quds Day rally in Tehran to suggest that the day seeks to raise awareness about all oppressed people worldwide.
And that was our special episode about the International Quds Day, support for the Palestinian cause, and how it resonates with people's own struggles against injustice in the South Asian region. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Humans have had an unprecedented impact on land, with vast consequences for climate change, food systems, and biodiversity, a major new UN report concludes. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Aruna Gandhraskar and Daisy Dune Riders. This article is published under the heading Human Activity Altered 70% of Earth's Land and Degraded 40% of It. Here's the story. Humans have had an unprecedented impact on land, with vast consequences for climate change, food systems, and biodiversity, a major new UN report concludes. It says that human activities have already altered 70% of Earth's land surface, degrading up to 40% of it. Four of the nine planetary boundaries, limits on how humans can safely use Earth's resources, have already been exceeded. Food systems, a catch-all term to describe the way humans produce, process, transport, and consume food, are the largest culprit when it comes to land degradation, the report says. They account for 80% of deforestation, 29% of greenhouse gas emissions, and the leading share of biodiversity loss. The degradation of land is perpetuated by steep inequalities. It notes that 70% of the world's agricultural land is controlled by just 1% of farms, primarily large agribusiness, the report notes. The report from the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification, UNCCD, urges world leaders to adopt a crisis footing to solve land degradation. The authors warn that at no other point in modern history has humanity faced such an array of familiar and unfamiliar risks and hazards. It projects that if business as usual continues to 2050, an additional 16 million square kilometers, an area almost the size of South America, could be degraded. By contrast, if the world prioritizes land protection and restoration, it could lead to the creation of 4 million kilometers of new natural areas by 2050, with benefits for tackling climate change and biodiversity loss. Carbon Brief walked through five key takeaways from the UN's Milestone Land Report. The new report is by the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification. The convention is the only legally binding framework that addresses desertification and the effects of drought and has 197 parties. It was established in 1994 via a direct decision at the 1992 Rio Earth Summit, which also gave the world the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and Convention on Biological Diversity. The UNCCD is focused on rehabilitation, conservation, and sustainable management of land and water resources and is the custodian for Sustainable Development Goal Target 15.3, which aims to, by 2030, combat desertification, restore degraded land and soil, including land affected by desertification, drought, and floods, and strive to achieve a land degradation neutral world. 5 years in the making, the second edition of the Global Land Outlook GLO2 analysis, future land scenarios, and the contributions of land-based restoration to climate mitigation, biodiversity protection, health, and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. The first edition, published in 2017, mostly outlined the drivers of desertification. The report was developed in partnership with 21 different organizations and cites more than 1,000 publications. Partners include the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the Convention on Biological Diversity, CBD, as well as the Indonesia-based Center for International Forestry Research and Cape Town-based climate consultancy, C4 Eco Solutions. The report comes just 2 weeks before the UNCCD's 15th desertification COP, scheduled to take place in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, from May 9th to 20th this year. The UN hopes COP15 will serve as a key moment in the fight against desertification, land degradation, and drought, as parties step into what it describes as the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration from 2021 to 2030. This aims to prevent, halt, and reverse ecosystem degradation on every continent and in every ocean. Governments are expected to build on the report's findings and offer a concrete response to the interconnected challenges of land degradation, climate change, and biodiversity loss, the UN says. The report is split into three parts. The first part presents the many challenges to land systems, from biophysical drivers in the S system to social and economic systems and their demands on land. The second part assesses land restoration activities and practices globally. The third part assesses the effectiveness and feasibility of global, national, and financial commitments to restoration. It sets out three scenarios through 2050: business as usual, a restoration scenario, and restoration and protection scenario. The report was welcomed by UN Biodiversity Chief Elizabeth Maruma, who was interviewed in depth by Carbon Brief last summer, who called it a must-read for the biodiversity community. In a statement, she said, "The future of biodiversity is precarious. We have already degraded nearly 40% and altered 70% of the land. We cannot afford to have another lost decade for nature and need to act now for a future of life in harmony with nature. The GLO2 shows pathways, enablers, and knowledge that we should apply to effectively implement the post-2020 global biodiversity framework." Carbon Brief presents five key takeaways from GLO2 and their significance for the world's climate and biodiversity. Humans have already altered more than 70% of the Earth's land area from its natural state, the report says. This has caused unparalleled environmental degradation and contributed significantly to global warming, according to the report. Because of human activity, an estimated $44 trillion, roughly half the world's annual economic output, is being put at risk by the depletion of natural resources, the report says. These resources underpin human and environmental health by regulating climate, water disease, pest, waste, and air pollution, while providing numerous other benefits such as recreation and cultural benefits, the report states. It cites analysis finding that at least 20% of the global land surface is now degraded, an area the size of the African continent. However, it adds that this estimate is conservative and notes that other assessments put the proportion of land degraded at between 20 and 40%. Degradation is particularly acute in dry land regions, which are today home to 1 in 3 people, the report adds.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program you will discuss issues, relevant questions and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children, and we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself, and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research.
Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Today, dear Sheikh, I would like to talk to you about this very, perhaps strange phenomena we find in teenagers who are growing up. And that is, you find these teenagers wearing some of the most strange and outrageous clothing, like you can imagine. Like, even if I say spiky hair, somebody's going to one up me and say, I've seen worse. But at least spiky hair, torn jeans, or maybe they only wear black, and they also put makeup on their faces and fingernails, and you know these trends that are...
The gothics.
The gothics, the emo punks, and all that. So what's up with that?
This is, again, one of the characteristics that that exist in the teenage group by itself, right?
Right, yeah.
And the characteristic is being focused upon themselves, right? They're focused upon themselves rather than others. They're more focused on, like we mentioned, they're focused upon their own thoughts. Like they're focused upon
pleasing
their
themselves,
own,
you mean?
Not pleasing themselves, trying to find themselves. I always bring this back to the establishing their personality type. So they're trying to figure out their own thought processes. What do I think? What am I more inclined towards? What subjects do I like? Am I into science? Am I into maths? Am I into arts? And then from not just the logic and psychological and mental self-focused and self-centrism where they're trying to explore themselves, but also physically they're focused upon themselves because they're never really paid attention to their body, but suddenly you see when they enter teenage, there are physical changes happening in them. Apart from the hormonal changes, apart from the puberty and all other things, they start noticing that their physical facial features are changing. Now the eyes are looking different, nose is growing a little more, lips are turning pinkish, or ears are growing bigger and start growing mustache and beard and stuff like that. Right. Now they start paying attention to themselves, and you will find girls particularly spending a lot of time in front of the mirror. Why? Because they never paid attention to themselves earlier, but now they're going through some physical changes, and now they start comparing themselves with others, not from the point of view of their thought structure and their ideologies, but also from their physical structures.
Their appearances.
That right. What looks good on me? Does this color look good on me? Should I wear eyelashes? Should I wear eyeliner? Should I wear lip balm? Should I wear lip lash? All those things, you know, makeup, to what extent, what kind of a dress, toned jeans, untoned jeans, purple color, blue color.
So is their appearance, dear Sheikh, based upon the social norms in a society, you would say?
See, every society has its own social norms. But again, there's this element that we discussed in the earlier section, that the element of, if you don't listen to me, I am not going to listen to you. Therefore, what? If you tell me not to break rules, I am going to break rules. So if you tell me that a decent dressing is a jeans which is not torn, I'm going to wear a torn jeans. Why? Because you're not acknowledging me, I'm not going to acknowledge you. If you say a decent hairstyle is to comb your hair, I'm going to wear spiky hairs. Why? Because you don't respect me by not listening to me, by not giving me that respect and understanding. And I'm going to do the exact same with you, counter it with that same behavior.
Right. With that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, just before we went on a break, we were talking about one of the reasons why these teenagers, they dress in such a fashionista, outrageous, avant-garde, whatever you want to call it, manner, is because they're lashing out against not being heard or listened to. Would you also say, because humans, they are social creatures, they want to find cliques and people they click with? You mentioned if they love science, they're going to dress like with the T-shirts with slogans that are scientific or some insider jokes, and then they change their appearance, right?
Correct. It's not just about clicking, but it is also about being attractive enough to be part of the group.
Attractive. Right? Do you mean physical appearance?
Physically attractive. Okay. And that's why you will find the girls and the boys, both of them, experimenting with their clothing styles. Sometimes they want to wear the X kind of a shoe. Then they would want to low-waist jeans.
Right.
And, you know, high heels. All that combinations, right, until they arrive at a conclusion that, oh, look, this kind of a t-shirt with this kind of a jeans looks good on me. Others might tell you, you look like a fool, but for him, he's like, I look good. So for him, his own opinion, his own understanding of himself matters a lot more than what others have to say. So I remember one of my friends, he tried jeans, t-shirts, spiky hairs, long hairs, and then he finally arrived at a conclusion that I want to wear the normal hair, but my dressing style would be that I would wear jeans, and I would wear a professional shirt that someone would wear to office when they go to work.
Right.
So he would buy those white and light blue shirts, and then he would wear a tie which would be, you know, pulled out, like, you know, you pull off your tie at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of dressing he would wear, and people would say that you look stupid, and like, no, I look cool. And
he was an office worker in essence.
He was a teenager, but he wanted to look grown up, you know, coming back from office with his tie pulled down, and he would spend money on buying different ties. At least he had a collection of 16 to 18 ties. Imagine a teenager who's a 17-year-old having 18 ties, not going to work at all. But he's like, I look cool in this. So he gave more importance to his own opinion than to others' opinion.
And about giving more importance and valuing their own opinion, at least in regards to their appearance, more than others, when we say others, isn't just others who are older than them?
Exactly. You rightly pointed out. I just realized when I said others, I was including a lot of people.
Because they value the opinion of their
age groups. That, you know, the same age group, if they tell them you're looking stupid, they would change.
That's the seal of approval.
And this brings back us to that point that which you mentioned, to click among the group, to associate with them, to be part of a social
construction.
Correct. Social structure of their own age group. So they will try and comb their hairs in a particular style that everybody else approves of. They would dress in a way that everybody else approves of. The eyeliners, the lip lashes, everything is based on what everybody else likes around.
Let's go ahead and take a quick break, dear Sheikh.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Now, Sheikh, just before we went on a break, we said that teenagers, they value their own opinion more than what others say. When we say others, we mean the older grown-up,
older
generations, and so on and so forth. But for me, when you say that they value their own opinions on certain matters, at least about dress and appearance, I see it as perhaps a golden opportunity for Muslim parents to instill the Islamic dress values and dress codes, wouldn't you say?
That would be an amazing step to take. But here's a major challenge, you know. Imagine the parents trying to instill Islamic dressing style, and imagine hijab, right? So they're trying to instill hijab in the girl. But when she goes to school, there's so much peer pressure from the friends around that they have their hair, you know, left open. Someone's coloring their hair. Someone's wearing, you know, little beads in their hair or butterflies in their hair. And everyone's got a different style. And everyone's showing off their hair and making more friends because they look more beautiful with that kind of a hairstyle, so on and so forth. And these people are so much under pressure that, you know, they have their hair hidden. They don't. They can't wear makeup according to Islam. No adornments, no jewelry, no bracelets.
It is very tough to be a religious Muslim
exactly.
in a non-Islamic country.
Exactly. So I don't see it as a golden opportunity here. But I would definitely say that the parents need to learn how to manage the situation, because you would have girls wearing torn jeans and tight tops, and we are telling our daughters not to look like them because it is not appropriate according to Islam, and they have this constant being laughed upon, peer pressure, including teachers. I had a case where one of the parents approached me and said, what do I tell my child? You know, she comes back home, she's just a six-year-old or seven-year-old kid, and she comes back home and says, my teacher tells me that, look, all the girls in the class, they have beautiful hair and they're showing their beautiful hair. Don't you feel like showing your beautiful hair to us?
Wow.
And this girl is like, what do I do? I do want to show my hair. But on the other hand, so is Islam really a religion of freedom? It's not giving me the freedom to show my hair. So is there really freedom in Islam? That's the kind of psychological
right.
pressure that is being built upon children
right.
right from that age of 6, 7. One might question that, you know, why is a seven-year-old girl wearing hijab? Because if you wait till they reach puberty and bulugh and that time
it's
of wujubat, and then you say, now wear hijab,
right.
that's not going to happen. You got to train them a little before. So there's a lot of psychological pressure that is built on the children right from that age. Someone might question that, why does a seven-year-old girl need to wear hijab? Like I mentioned, waiting till they reach puberty,
right.
that is too late to start hijab. They're going to come back and say, no, we're not going to wear hijab, especially when they're 9. You got to train them when they're 6, slowly, you know, giving them that freedom. Wear
right.
it, don't wear it, it's up to you.
You want to make use of this phase where they're very
exactly.
stubborn, where they do not care about the opinions of others.
Exactly. So you need
right.
to mold them before that.
Yeah.
So right from age 6, you start training them till they reach 9. They're already adjusted to wearing hijab regularly, every day, every hour, and then it becomes comfortable. So like you mentioned, it's a golden opportunity. No, I wouldn't say golden opportunity, but I would definitely want to bring the point that pay special attention here. Learn how to handle the situation and manage it well. If you don't manage it well, it's going to backfire. And this very rebellious behavior from the child is going to lead you into the element where she's going to say, I'm not doing hijab anymore. Rather, I'm not Muslim at all, right?
Right.
And that's how it might backfire. So you should know how to deal with this scenario.
Sheikh, would you say then perhaps that it is, if not impossible, very difficult to raise a religious, conservative Muslim girl in a Western society?
I don't want to call them conservative. See, somewhere, I don't know why people categorize them radical,
when
conservative.
When I say conservative, is because I do not want to include the liberals.
I know,
who are
I understand.
Very liberal with how
I
they
understand,
dress.
But,
right.
but Islam does not categorize that way. Islam says you're either Muslim or not
right.
Muslim.
Islam
so
is
either
Islam.
You're, exactly.
Yeah.
Either you're following it or you're not following it. Islam is a package by itself.
Yeah.
You can't say it's like a buffet lunch. I pick some part and leave some part. So if you are a Muslim, don't think it's so much more challenging, you know, the way we put it, especially when we say radical conservative, that's when it becomes difficult. But if you say he's a Muslim and here are the things they need to follow, I don't think there's much of a challenge. Yes, there is difficulty, but I wouldn't say impossible. There are always ways and methods, and it can be easily achieved, inshallah.
And keeping that in mind, we will have to end today's program. I thank you for contributing to this discussion, and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.